What's up, guys? Welcome to Unapologetic Live. I'm your host, Amala Epinobi, and today we're going to be doing, you know, some of the favorite episodes that I like to do, which is going through and reacting to Jubilee's Middle Ground. But before we get to that, guys, please like, subscribe, click the notification bell to be notified every day when we go live. That's 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern for you guys, that we're here talking through the hot topics of the day. Yeah, and I think for today's chat, on YouTube at least, we're going to be subscriber only. So you got to be subscriber to hop in the chat, to be able to react to the things that we're saying. And of course, I do read the chat on my handy-dandy phone, handy-dandy iPad, while we are doing the show. And I love reacting to the things that you guys say and getting a little bit of your input. Today, like I said, we're going to be going through this Jubilee Middle Ground video. And this is about racism, which is, you know, a typical concept for some of their Middle Ground videos, where they bring people of different backgrounds, life experiences, viewpoints, to discuss one singular topic. In today's episode, they've brought together white people, black people, and a biracial group of people to discuss racism as it pertains to their own lives, how it affects people of other races, and just how they view the subject matter in itself, specifically in America. So we're going to get into this Middle Ground right now. They will posit a statement. And if you agree with the statement, you walk forward and you start talking about why you agree with the statement. And if you disagree, you stay in the back. So we'll also be participating in that sense and deciding whether or not we're going to walk forwards for some of these statements. Let's go.
Step forward if you agree with the prompt. White people also experience racism.
Pause. I'm going to be running forward in this one, Taylor.
I'm right there with you. I might get there first.
Yeah. Of course, white people experience racism. To me, racism is simply saying, because I am a certain race, this is superior, or a people of another race are inferior. We're generally just giving attributes to people simply because of their race, whether those are negative or positive attributes. Qualifies as racism for me. So certainly white people can experience racism from people of all other races.
I think racism is definitely not a one race against the other. It goes always. It doesn't matter if you're white, if you're black, if you're Asian, it doesn't matter. You could experience racism no matter what color your skin is.
Agreed.
I think that people have a propensity to kind of have an aversion towards what's different from them. I've been called a cracker before. I've been told I was going to get beaten up because I was white. I would argue that on a systemic level, white people don't experience racism the same way a lot of other races experience racism. But I would say on an individual level, any group is capable of being racist towards another group as well.
So the argument against this position frequently is that racism is a system, not a sentiment in the United States. And I agree with that really strongly, but at the same time, I'm Jewish.
I very much disagree with that sentiment, that racism is somehow attached to a system or an institution rather than a sentiment. Racism is just racism. If I looked at Taylor and I said, you're white and that's horrible and I hate you and I don't want to talk to you, which would be really weird considering I'm half white. But if I did that, not only would Taylor be sad, but that would be racist. It doesn't need to be attached to some sort of system or institution. Now, I'm sure they're going to make the argument that it is or that it has to be and that white people experience maybe a different form of racism, but that would simply not be true in any way that we've ever known racism as a society. And we can talk about systemic examples of racism, which have existed pretty prevalently here in the United States as well as in other countries. We can talk about Jim Crow, we can talk about slavery, we can talk about segregation and have conversations about reparations, and those were, I should say, systemic problems. But as far as right now, it's still racism.
I'm racially white and have definitely experienced racism, discrimination. The paradox is that most of that racism is coming from white people or European society, white nationalism, etc., that's directed at Jews. So I'm Dane.
Question.
And I'm Jewish. I'm proud of being Jewish and being connected to an ancient religion and culture, but I'm not proud to be white, I would say. White privilege, I think, is an aspect of American society. I think it exists. When I go to a job interview, I don't have to worry about my hairstyle or the way I normally speak or my name. And that's something perhaps a black person would have to worry about.
Pause. I think if anybody who's going to a job interview should probably worry about what their hair looks like, what they're wearing, and it's certainly how they speak. Now, we can talk about black individuals who grew up in lower income areas and speak in something that some might deem to be Ebonics. That is something that you probably would want to work on before you go into a job interview. And, that should be a concern that you have regardless of what your race is. There are plenty of white people who grow up in lower income areas or not at all and still speak in what is similar Ebonics to a black person who would most likely, if you went to a job interview speaking like that, they'd go, I don't know if that's going to work. We've got customers coming in, this and that. Any reason why you would not want somebody speaking that way in your place of work would be reasonable. So to say that you don't have to worry about that as a white person, I don't know that would be true. I mean, you can be really laissez-faire about going into a job interview, but you would want to look and speak your best, regardless of what race you are.
Can the disagreeer step forward?
So I just want to say that I want to validate everyone's individual experiences. I do also believe that white people experience bias, prejudice, but the reason I did not step forward is because, by definition, racism is tied to power and economics. You talked about systemic discrimination. I don't feel white people experience racism by definition and by actual concept.
What is
these definitions of racism that have some sort of attachment to a power or system or a long-standing historical privilege? Those are recent definitions. Like, those are not widely renowned definitions of racism, although they are coming to be that way because of social justice efforts. Racism simply means, I'm looking at you because of your race. I think that you are superior or inferior due to those factors, or I give you positive or negative attributes due to the factor of your race. That's simply it for me as far as the definition goes, and that has been what was widely accepted as the definition of racism until very recently.
Is the definition of racism, and who wrote that definition?
In the late 1500s, early 1600s, there was slavery. They started bringing over slaves, but there was really no concept of classifying people in terms of race. It's just we're bringing these people over and they're slaves. What ended up happening is some of the slave owners who were white started mixing with some of the slaves. And now here you have these black people that look like the people that are owning things. So they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. The theory of race was formed to classify a group of people who would be lesser than and have less economic power, and this would be imposed against them for hundreds of years. So that has not been the white experience in this country, but it does not invalidate the things that white people experience. It's just not racism by definition. Is it prejudice? Is it bias? Is it wrong? Yes.
Mine is simple. If one person treats another person differently because of the color of their skin, to me, that's racism.
Jimmy's based, baby. Jimmy knows what's up. Jimmy's like, you just gave me this long, thorough, definition that you've derived from looking through the lens of social justice. I'm giving you what the definition of racism is, and that's what it is. And to say that there was absolutely never a concept of race before the Europeans, thought this up in their brain to institute the slave trade would be completely false. And we've seen societies time and time again make judgments based on race. You see things like caste systems and feudal systems that are, in a lot of ways, reliant upon looking at people's skin color and saying the darker you are, the less you are valued. In India, you saw the caste system where they said, the darker your skin, the more untouchable you are. You are in the lowest form of human caste that you could possibly be. So it's not purely a European idea, and we've recognized race and recognized differences in skin tone for a very, very long time, which is, again, why I say racism has nothing to do with power and systems. It has everything to do with looking at somebody and going, because you look like that, I'm going to treat you this way.
I will tell you that I was stopped by the police plenty of times when I was a young man. And I will also tell you that I then decided to spend 35 years as a policeman. I'll tell you that I stopped lots of kids coming home from school. Depending on who it was that I stopped, the first thing out of their mouth would be, "You only stopped me because I'm black." And I would say, "You're driving a sports car with a back window that's this big. I can't see who's driving, and I stopped you because you're doing 95 and a 55. I had no idea who I was pulling over until I stopped you. Now, if I treat you differently because you're black, then I'm a racist. But if I write you the same ticket that I was going to write you before I knew who was behind the wheel, I'm not."
Exactly. I'm glad you used that example, and I want to commend you for your service.
Pause real quick, because I know this is going to be, you know, because she got a little smile on her face, that little pride smile, like we're going to bring in something that's going to invalidate what he just said. But quickly, before we get there, I want to shout out Eric Cruz for your super chat. He said, "Actually, white people have only had power in the last couple hundreds of years. Before then, it was the Arab, Persian, Ottoman, and Greco-Roman societies." Honestly, I feel like we need to start integrating history into some of the shows that we do, maybe doing Throwback Thursdays like we used to do in the past, because it's important to know these things. Because a lot of what extreme progressives rely on when making these arguments, specifically towards race, but towards other social issues that we face in this country as well, they rely on little picked out portions of history. And you'll constantly hear the same exact arguments, no matter the person in front of you giving them. And if you are well-versed in history, and have a rebuttal to them, you will do far better than some people do when they're on these shows. But so far, I'm very impressed by the spectrum of belief that is being shown here and the respect that is being shown here. There's no screaming. There's no attitude. It's just simply people talking back and forth. So I love that. It's great.
For our country, but I do want to say, because I've actually taught classes for the LAPD and for their cadets about these issues. But what I can say, which is
So she's one of those DEI trainers. She's one of those diversity, equity, and inclusion trainers, I would guess, or something in that realm of critical race theory, of these fundamental critical race theorists. You know, your Richard Delgados, your Gene Stefanik, your Derek Bells. I imagine she is a scholar of sorts when it comes to those topics. So she says she's taught the LAPD specifically on these issues. Let's see what she has to say.
A statistic, and which is also a fact, is that 60% of our prison population is African American.
Different issue.
Yes, but let me finish, please. Is African American males, right? When you go into a system and you are kept in that system and you're cycled through probation and there is a systematic sequence of oppression, that's not happening to white males. So it's bigger than just the stop itself. It's the system.
So many things to unpack there. Okay, so we're talking about the system at large. Well, she completely did not have anything to say about what he actually said about his experience as a police officer, how he wouldn't even know who he's pulling over if he tried. It would be virtually impossible to figure that out. So we just ignore that argument for the most part, although I'm not blaming her. There's a lot to discuss here. When we talk about the incarceration rate, again, if we just go and look at class, that would be a great way to break down the incarceration rate. But let's make it about race and let's talk about that. She does not address the rate of criminality, although I imagine her response to that would be that black communities are over-policed. But if you look at the rate of criminality, specifically with violent crimes, it does seem to be particularly high with young black males. And it's not the same thing that we see with young white males. So to say that this is simply because of a system and jump to that conclusion without having any look at the cultural factors that can exist to create such a problem. And it is a problem to have a complete section of society where the male portion of the society, a very important part of that demographic, is largely put in jail. That is a problem that needs to be addressed. But if we scream about racism or talk about racism very calmly and blame it on the system rather than talking about the culture that creates these issues, we will get nowhere. We will get nowhere. Like I said before in an earlier video, police don't simply show up to neighborhoods just to be there and go, you know, I know there's no crime happening here, but I'm going to arrest you and you and you and you and you. They respond to, you know, the demand that they have in these particular areas. I'm sure the government does not want to be paying full salaries for police officers that aren't needed in these areas. And if they are, shame on them. But that doesn't seem to be what is happening here. So we can talk about instances of racism that might appear on an individual level. I'm sure there are judges who are viewing black males far more harshly than they're viewing white males because it's constantly what they're seeing. And you can become jaded to the things that you see constantly, constantly, constantly in your courtroom when you are giving sentencing. And that might be why we see sentences be a little bit higher for black males, although that doesn't account for the violence of the crime, the weapon that was used, how many people were put in harm's way during the crime being committed. But if we do not address the cultural problems that seem to supersede the evidence of systemic racism, we will get nowhere, absolutely nowhere. So we have to start admitting that, even though it's a hard thing to admit.
My name is Sierra. I'm an actor, a speaker, and a human rights activist. I'm very proud to be African American, to be black. The challenges that come with being black, also being a black woman, are very real. I'm at a place in my life where I'm acknowledging these things are real. Discrimination is real. The systematic oppression of black people is very real. But I will succeed in spite of that.
You know, I wish when people succeeded as black individuals in America or any sort of background in America, they just went, look, I succeeded. She says how it's very hard to be a black woman in America. She said she's an actress, she's a speaker, she's a human rights activist, she's doing all these things, she's beautiful, she's confident, she's sitting here in an LA studio filming this video. I just find it so hard to believe that there is some sort of deep-set struggle for growing up black in America. I'm sorry, I just find it very hard to believe, and so far there's been very little evidence to prove that, especially seeing a beautiful, young, successful woman talk about how hard it is. I'm unconvinced.
The police force is foundationally racist.
I would not be stepping forward for that. The police force is not foundationally racist, in my opinion.
I want to start off by saying I don't think that every cop out there today is racist.
Same.
I think there are a lot of them who are really doing good work. What I know from the establishment of the policing in the United States, that is directly from the slave catchers who were hired to catch runaway slaves and bring them back home.
Yeah, I agree that all cops aren't racist. I had plenty of interactions with police that were fine, but you know, I was told by a former police officer who was, you know, a cop who decided he didn't want to do that anymore that, you know, the training is pretty much specialized for only colored people, especially black people, that if you're around them, they're the most dangerous, so you have to act in certain situations or react in certain situations, you know.
I think I just really want to emphasize that I really think that there are some officers who are white that don't even believe that they're doing anything that may be racially motivated because they're simply doing what they were taught to do.
I come from a police family, and I like to add, they do offer diversity trainings in the academy. So either it needs to be more extensive, or maybe we need to take it a step back and fix the selection process, because that process could be inherently racist.
Okay, I wish we would just kind of sort of broadly spoke about the police force. Each of them gave little very broad quips without any sort of direct specific criticism of the police force, so there's not really much to rebut there. I do want to mention police forces existed long before slave catchers existed. This has been a long-standing institution for all countries virtually that have ever, all societies virtually that have ever existed have needed police forces in some way, shape, or form to keep things in line and to stop and deter crimes. So while slave catching might have pushed forth a police force here in the United States of America, that does not mean that those ideas of enslaving and capturing black people are still upheld by the current police force that exists here in the United States. And in fact, there's no stats to support a claim like that. Where we see studies, like a study out of Washington State University that says police officers are actually more hesitant to get involved with an altercation with a black suspect rather than a white suspect because they know what sort of backlash can come from that. They know the cultural aspect of what they're doing. They know the court of political opinion is not going to look at them very kindly for the things that they do, specifically when it pertains to black people. In legislatively now, it seems like in progressive states right now, we're just letting people off the hook for for all crimes and specifically black people in the name of restorative justice is what they'll call it. In California, we have things like zero bail policy, where criminals are now being emboldened to do whatever it is that they want because they know they're going to get out on zero bail. We have plea deals that are just being thrown out like candy at parades because they don't want to have the stigma of having an incarceration rate that disproportionately affects people of color. But again, we can run with the racism narrative. We can do all the policy and all the diversity, equity, and inclusion programs that you can think of in any given state, in any given city, in any given police department. But does it change outcomes? It does not change outcomes. And if the outcome change looks like, hey, there's less black people in prison, but you have crime that is running rampant in the streets that we cannot take care of, so much so that the citizens are leaving to move to other states that take crime more seriously, then we've done the wrong thing and we've misdiagnosed the problem. And that's exactly what we're experiencing right now.
Hello, my name is Nia and I am black. I'm proud of my race because when I look back historically at what people of my heritage have gone through, and to see where we are now, it's remarkable, and it definitely pushes me to continue to be resilient and innovative as they were.
I agree. That is remarkable. What a remarkable thing to be held down that badly, systemically, legislatively, no bodily autonomy, as the left loves to say, and to be where we are now is a beautiful thing, but there are many people to credit for that as well. But it is astounding. I completely agree.
Historically, people formed groups, villages. Some people were hunters, some people were farmers, and then you had whoever was going to protect the group. And over hundreds of years, thousands of years, whatever it is, that's how we wind up having cops, firemen, armies, and navies. Community policing as a theory is a good idea. As a practice, it has some hiccups. When I show up at your house because you and your husband got into it and he beats you up and I'm friends with him, so do I want to take him to jail? He's my friend. Or I live in the same neighborhood and I go deal with some guy who's a really bad dude and he says, I know where you live, I know where your kids are.
Jimmy's just got logic and reason on his side. You can come in and you can tell, obviously the rest of the crowd here is quite young and Jimmy's got some life experience on him, worked as a police officer himself, and has clearly some wisdom in what he's saying. And he's so calm and kind about the criticism that he's levying to some of the arguments that they're making. And I think that's fantastic. And that is a massive issue with community policing. There has to be a degree of separation. I'm not saying it has to be a large degree of separation, but a degree of separation between police officers and the communities they police for the very reasons that he stated. And even with that being said, I mean, the police officers that I've met, she says she works closely with LAPD, I would love to know where, because they are deeply invested in the communities that they police. They know every single name, every single face. A man could be all the way down the block, and the police officers that I work with could see him, look at his shoes even, and go, that's so-and-so. And I know him because his mom is here and his two sisters go to this school and all this stuff. You have to know the communities that you police and you have to know them well, even with the degree of separation of not living directly in them. And that's a wonderful thing that allows police officers to be there, to be present, to be connected, but also maintain a little bit of objectivity when it comes to their job and the hard things that they have to do with their jobs. That's all I have to say about that.
So, to some degree, we have to have a little separation. This is going to get into a hot button topic, but I will tell you that, you know, when I watched the horrible video of George Floyd, I will tell you that I can justify many of the things that happened, but I cannot justify 9 minutes on his neck or back. But what I can also tell you is I, as a policeman, and this is my personal opinion only too, the officer who was on him for 9 minutes, he probably spent too much time in the same neighborhood dealing with the same problems over and over again, mm-hmm. that he became jaded.
Isn't that what being a police officer is?
Yeah. It's a social service job.
Yeah. See, this is what happens when you have a utopic view of how things are meant to work. In an ideal, utopic world, all right, we all live in our little neighborhoods with the cul-de-sac, and we pick a couple men and women, and they're the police officers, and they volunteer themselves, and that's their job, and they go around policing the community from the time they start their job till they retire. And that's how it works, and they stay in the same little district, and they do their job, and they never become jaded because of the things that they see. They never experience things like PTSD. They never have the same run-ins with the same exact person who decides to engage in criminal activity anytime they get the chance. But that's utopia. That's not real. It's not what neighborhoods look like. It's not how some of these worse, more dangerous areas in America function. And we can look at it that way and say, we should just have the police officers work there and they can go and police the same community for as long as they can. But that's not how it works, and that's not how they look. In LAPD specifically, and things like the gang unit, they have gang unit officers that are constantly cycling in and out of that specific division. And they'll go from gang to vice to intel to other departments. And sometimes they'll do just 3 years at a time. You stay 3 years in the gang unit, and then you leave to another unit. Because 3 years, while only just enough to get your footing and get to know all the different gangs that are operating in the given neighborhood or district that you're in, it's enough time to also get jaded and to see the same people, have the same run-ins, have the same problems, and then go, we need to refresh. We need to move you somewhere else before this becomes a problem. Because that's just what we do. That's how the human psyche works. It's the human condition. And we have to be realistic about that, or else we do run into problems. And in his statement about Derek Chauvin and what could possibly have happened with George Floyd could possibly be absolutely correct, knowing what we know about their job and their occupation and how stressful it can be.
And you're assigned to that district or that community.
But I think you need to move around so that you get to see other things. You don't become that jaded.
And he knows
the police,
they do.
No matter what your race is, we have to be integrated all together with the community. And it doesn't have to be community policing, but we all have to understand each other more. I think cultural competency would be very helpful. Like, that's my issue. Whether or not the foundations of the police force was or still was racist, now we can change that, but it starts with cops. Like, at the end of the day, it's the bad police officers that are our issue. Not all police officers, but the bad police officers, we need to vet them out, and the good police officers, we need to, encourage them to be amongst the community.
How do we vet them out?
By making the police unions accountable, because I feel like that demographic of officers, they're actually making things a lot worse for the other officers that are actually just trying to do their job. I think that we need to get some type of real accountability, that I don't think the police should be policing themselves. So when those cops that aren't upholding their oath, they can be properly removed instead of getting all of these passes.
The bad police.
She is absolutely right in that. And that's what I love about this conversation, because there's a lot of balance here. I'm listening to the people who represent the more progressive ideas, and sometimes they're saying things that, absolutely, I agree with you on that. The police unions and how difficult it is to fire somebody who has committed a heinous crime, in my opinion, under some of these police departments is insane. It is insane how hard it is to get somebody out of there or to even properly investigate something that they've done wrong. Now, don't get me wrong. They are very, very active in investigating their police officers, in looking at instances where they may have done something wrong. If you get arrested by a police officer and you say, I want a supervisor here right now, they should be. Your police officer should be calling a supervisor, and they should be there in very little time to watch over whatever situation you now currently find yourself in. So there are several ways where they have safeguards to trying to find police officers who are doing the wrong thing. But do police officers slip through the cracks? Absolutely. Another thing they do is auditing. So police officers, at least here at LAPD, will get a call that sounds like any other call, and they'll show up to a domestic violence call, a mental health call, somebody who's brandishing a weapon, and they will have to go through. And to them, this is absolutely normal. You see the suspect, you handle everything, you do your paperwork. But what they don't know is that these are actually undercover cops who are pretending to be making these calls and pretending to be people at the scene. And they will be fully audited and they will get a report sent over to whoever the higher up is for them. Also, if you get in an incident as a police officer where you have to discharge your weapon, there is a formal process and investigation that is attached to that. And every about 6 months to a year or so, they're redoing their simulation training, at least with LAPD. Again, this is department specific. So there are many things that police departments are doing now to vet and get out bad officers, but that does not always work. And I have heard horrible things about what some police officers, because they have their badge and their uniform, have been able to get away with. And when they get caught, we're talking a couple years of investigation where they are either on paid leave, on paid administrative leave, you know, they're sitting at home, still have police officer listed as their occupation, still are getting paid by the state and the department to sit at home and do nothing after doing something absolutely horrible. And it's because they are protected in this way. So there are certainly issues and places where people need to be held accountable. You have police officers who will commit crimes, get investigated by the police department, get fired, and never see a day in court, never see a day in jail for the things that they've done, where any other normal person would be in jail for doing them. So, problem that she stated absolutely does exist.
Police officers, I hate the term, like, the bad apple. It's like, no, you're a faulty grenade. Like, you're ruining your whole department reputation.
She's right.
I feel like I was held up to higher standards working at Whole Foods sometimes. I got three chances out. But, like, Derek had so many.
17 reports before 17 George
Floyd. 17 reports. It's like, get him out of there. What are you guys doing?
Devil's advocate for that argument there, a police officer. If you're in a profession that's going to get a complaint, it's going to be a police officer. You're never going to meet somebody on their worst day than being a police officer who's pulling somebody over for a traffic stop, who's instigating a domestic violence issue, who's doing anything on any given day. I imagine you're going to amass a multitude of complaints. Although some police officers do manage to make it through their whole career without a single complaint, and kudos to those people. Because you are meeting somebody on their very worst day and having to be an authority figure at that time to often adults. So very easy to pile up complaints as a police officer. Now, I can't speak to the 18 complaints that were filed against Derek Chauvin, but 18 does seem to be a lot. And I imagine if the police department was running properly, there would have been thorough investigations into that. But I do not know. Can't speak to that specific situation.
Do you think police officers, and I genuinely am curious, do you think they should get paid more?
I think police officers should get paid more. I also think police officers should do less. Why do I get sent to all of the mental health cases? Why do I get sent to all of these things?
Okay, first off, we have a super chat I want to read really quick from Julian Giangrande. Systemic racism ended sometime between 1965 and 1970. I am inclined to agree with you, at least legislatively. And we could talk about in practice and whether or not that's different, but I am inclined to agree with you on that one. Thank you for the super chat. Now, he just made a point. He said, you know, police officers should get paid more, but they should do less. Why am I being called to a mental health call? Now, there's numerous answers to this, but the most obvious one for me is you do not know what you are walking into when you get called for a mental health situation. You have no idea what you are going to need. And if you send somebody, like a social worker, to a mental health call, which sounded completely normal over the phone, and something else happens where you now have an unarmed person who's responding to this, who gets hurt in some way, who is not equipped to deal with whatever they show up to see, you have a problem. Now, should we have a system set in place of some sort, and this is just spitballing here, where police officers show up, you know, they scope out the situation of a mental health call, and they go, hey, okay, this is out of my hands. There doesn't seem to be anything violent here. The situation doesn't seem to be escalating in any way, shape, or form. I'm going to call social work, and social work is going to come take care of this. Absolutely. I would be all for looking at a proposal like that and working out the details and having that happen. But you cannot just blindly send in social workers to mental health calls, and we've seen this fail time and time again with just regular social work visits, where the kids end up dying and custody problems, the mental health patient ends up dying, the social worker ends up getting hurt in some way, shape, or form. So to think that we should remove police from that situation would be false. And you can look up videos where this happens, and it is horrifying. You get a call that says, oh, well, the couple next door is arguing, and it's a boyfriend and girlfriend, and you go, well, I don't think we need a police officer for that. They just seem to be screaming. Police show up, and they get shot and killed. So you never know what you're going into, and you want somebody who's equipped to deal with any given situation of escalation when they arrive.
Now, I'll tell you why I get sent to them, is because we'll stop sending the police there, and then something horrible and tragic is going to happen, and they're going to say, why didn't we have a cop there?
Oh, well, he made the
Do
point. There you go.
We need to have different divisions like mental health and just other, you know, or maybe even specific police that are just for the schools. Like, do you think that that would help with a lot of the issues?
No. We do have specialized police officers in certain things. But if we keep specializing and we get so compartmentalized that I can't go, I'm right across the street from you when you're screaming for help. Yeah. That's not what I do. Got to go find the guy that deals with screaming women or whatever it is. My name is Jimmy and I am a retired police officer. I'm not going to tell you that there are no racists on the police department.
Of course.
I don't think blacks were historically treated fairly under the law. I think that we have made great progress, great strides. I think we have to continue to get better, but I also think we probably see racism to this day in places where it maybe isn't.
One of the things...
Of course, we get the YouTube ads. He's just made wonderful points throughout that entire thing. I think a lot of what we are seeing right now is attributing racism to things where racism is not present whatsoever. And it's sad to say, but a lot of people just lack the ability, but just don't want to open their mind enough to look past that and go, well, maybe I could be wrong. Maybe this could be something other than racism.
Okay. Sometimes wish I was a different race.
I sometimes wish I was a different race. Taylor, do you wish you were ever a different race? Would you walk forward for this one?
I would not walk forward for it.
I would not walk forward
either. Call it white privilege.
Yeah, I would not walk forward either for this. I've never had a time in my life where I've thought, I wish I was something different than what I am. Broadly. You know, you could say, I wish I was prettier than what I am. I wish I was fitter than what I am. But I mean different in terms of race. Never thought that.
I'd say not so much these days, but definitely 100% when I was a kid, I wish I was white. I grew up with my white mom. I didn't see my black side of my family after a certain point. I grew up in a small town. I was often the only student of color, definitely the only black kid. And I had this kinky hair. I couldn't figure out how to work with it. And everybody also would call me an Oreo. It was always just being othered. And so being a kid, you know, you just want to fit in. And for me, I wanted to be white. I just wanted to look like my mom, wanted the nice straight hair. And I just wanted to feel like included.
Yeah, I remember in elementary school, like I was thinking, no man is ever gonna like me because I freaking look like this. And I just remember hating my hair because as soon as puberty hit, it was just, it just blew up and people kept on asking, do you even need a pillow to sleep at night? I'm like, I can't stand these questions. I can't do this.
Oh, well, now those are considered microaggressions. So you can call somebody racist for saying that. I relate so much to these girls, not in the sense that I ever wished I was a different race, but all of these comments I got when I was a kid. I grew up in a predominantly white area. I was in more academically inclined classes, AP style things. So I was surrounded by other white kids for the most part. And I got things like, can I touch your hair? I've never seen hair like that. Do you need a pillow to sleep at night? Or can you use your hair as a pillow? I got called an Oreo my entire elementary school career. I was called an Oreo for having a black dad and a white mom. You know, I get it. It's totally fine. Kids recognize patterns. And when something falls outside of their pattern, they try to make sense of it. They ask questions about it. They make jokes about it. And that's totally fine. It's totally fine. It didn't bother me in any way, shape, or form. In fact, for me, it was something that, I have this sort of uniqueness about me, I guess, that people want to talk about and people are curious about, and they don't normally see this. And if I was a child and I grew up around other biracial kids or other black kids for the most part, and suddenly a white kid was in my class with straight hair and blue eyes and super pale skin, guess what we'd all be doing? we'd all be trying to touch his hair. We'd all be trying to look at him. And Taylor's experienced exactly that, if you want to share.
You saw my head move.
I'm like, Taylor knows.
Yeah, when I was in third grade, I come from a missionary family, and my family moved to Honduras when I was like 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And we went to a school that was like an English-speaking school, but we were the only white kids right. at the school with my siblings and I. And yeah, the lunch lady would make comments, and the young boys didn't like me because the girls liked my blonde hair and blue eyes and would talk about it and all that. But like, I was definitely treated differently, and people were curious about my, like, or I don't know, treated me differently, and was an outsider because of that. And it made me feel uncomfortable and excluded in some ways.
Right.
But I didn't take that as an indictment against this entire culture. I recognize that this is a normal human phenomenon, that people who see someone who has a different complexion or different traits physically than they do, it's an inherently curious thing. And I it was uncomfortable for me. I didn't enjoy it. It caused me some pain. But the healthy way for me to integrate that was, this is a problem with these people if they actually have a problem with me on the basis of my skin color or on my physical traits,
right?
And immutable characteristics. But that's on them if they're going to judge me or categorize me in that way. I still dealt with the pain, and as a kid, you don't have a great way to process that, but it didn't. I think you could easily let it like poison your heart and make it this indictment on this whole cultural group of people. Yeah. And I feel like that's where a lot of people end up these days.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly right. I mean, take 5 seconds to look up a white guy traveling to Africa and how the little kids treat him there. And it's exactly the same thing, regardless of where you are or where you go. And in America, it just happens to happen to people of color and biracial people. And that just happens to be the reality because we live in a predominantly white country, even though that's starting to shift anyways. But I mean, it's just a fact of life, in my opinion.
I'm Jordan, and I am biracial. I think being biracial is definitely like living in the in-between, because culturally, yes, I grew up white and I completely know that. Like, I was raised by my white mother, but then there's also a part where race is perceived, and it's what people put on you and how they respond to you in your everyday life.
It's so interesting because I grew up in predominantly non-black communities, and for some reason still, like, being the minority at home in the family as well as in school and in the world, I was always so proud to be black. I actually really yearned to be around other black people. So thankfully in college, that was an experience where even though we made up a small community, I was still able to, okay, this is like people that look like me.
I was in the military for 6 years. And I was usually the only Jew in my battalion. And I think that isolation produced a sort of pride and understanding of who I am and where I come from, so.
I have never wanted to be anything different than what I was, but that's because I really never thought about it. And to your all's point, maybe, I don't know, but maybe people treated you that way because there is this sense of wanting something that I haven't ever had before.
Jimmy,
I'd love
so
to have
kind.
A Lamborghini. You know what I mean? It's different than any other car I've ever had. It's different than what I grew up with.
I think
a fair and balanced point. I love the way he like knows exactly how he wants to say it, but maybe that's what they felt like. I don't want to speak to your specific situation, but maybe that's how they felt. And he's just very kind and wise. Great job.
For me, I mean, I was actually adopted by white parents and very diverse family. I think 6 out of 8 of us are all adopted, all different races. I kind of have my own story apart from everyone else. And the same for everyone else that was adopted in my family. They have their own story. I always had pride in it, but at the same time, my parents are my parents no matter the color of their skin. It's the people who raised me. And they raised me just not look at it through the lens of race. And that's what I've always done.
Awesome.
And I've never wanted to change my race at all.
Awesome. I'm Joshua's based, I can tell.
Yeah, I'm black. I've never experienced racism. I've experienced stuff from people from my own race. I grew up in a white family by white parents. I was constantly called whitewashed. It upset me, but I didn't let it get to me. Being black in America, to me, is just being an American in America, just like any other person.
Beautiful.
Take care of your skin.
Oh my gosh, not another YouTube ad about taking care of your skin. Thank you so much for that. Okay, let's continue.
White privilege exists.
White privilege exists. I am not walking forward for this one. Taylor!
Not walking forward. We're in lockstep.
We're in lockstep. I don't think you can attribute something to a particular group of people simply by looking at their skin color, and privilege is one of those things. I do not agree that white privilege exists, and let's get into the argument.
I mean, America was founded by white people, for white people at the time. All of the institutions were designed to benefit white people. So, I mean, of course, white privilege lingers into society today. You can't deny that.
Where I would argue with you.
But you can. You can deny that. And I love that we're having these conversations, but I think something that needs to be injected into them is there is a difference between was and is. Was and is. Was there a particular privilege that came along with whiteness when you were in America prior to the Civil Rights Act? Yes. Is there white privilege that currently exists in the United States of America? I'm going to go as far as say no. Now, are there white people that benefit from privileges based around historical context of maybe their ancestors owned slaves, or maybe their ancestors were able to build a business when black families could not? And they are now reaping the benefits of what their ancestors have done? Yes. And does that speak to a certain degree of privilege? Yes. But are there certain white people that do not exercise that privilege whatsoever? Yes. And if we can answer all those questions and yes, and say that these things exist and that there are certain white people that don't benefit from them, then white privilege does not exist. Because you have white people in this group. I mean, Taylor's one of them. I keep pointing to Taylor because Taylor's my resident
token white guy. Token white guy
today. Token white guy. Taylor doesn't benefit from any of the privileges that they're going to talk about when it comes to American history. Yet we still tell Taylor that white privilege exists because of our systems and institutions. So you can't do something like that. It's actually inherently racist to look at a group of people and say, because your skin color, you have this. Like I said, positive or negative. It's a problem.
Just a little bit is, I think we throw out the term white privilege far too often for things that aren't necessarily white privilege.
Agreed.
I've got to agree with you completely on that one. I think there's generational white privilege for sure, but I think now it's almost used as a reason to not try as hard. If we stop doing that, just really like work for it and not use white privilege as an excuse, then we could really get somewhere as a black in the black community.
Mm-hmm. I would respectfully disagree. Mm-hmm. Like, all of that is true to an extent. Mm-hmm. Like, I graduated university during the pandemic, the height of it. I went abroad for university. I got 2 degrees. I graduated with honors. I learned to speak 2 languages. I should have been able to get a job right away, right? No. It took me 9 months before I was able to get a job.
Anecdotal.
I had to go completely outside of my field. But then when I looked at all of my white colleagues who were in my program, all of them were hired immediately.
I need to introduce you to my daughter. She's white. Took her a long time.
And I'm not saying that. I'm saying
just she didn't get her job in what her degree is in either.
I respect that, but my point is saying me comparing myself to the white students who were directly in my position.
That doesn't mean anything. I'm sorry, that doesn't mean anything. That's anecdotal. There could have been so many different things. The way they formatted their resume, what they wrote on it, how they introduced themselves, how they did in the interview, what their cover letter looked like. If you submitted a cover letter, there's so many other factors, and this is the problem that we have. If you guys are wanting to have these conversations about race and discrimination, all of these things, I urge you, I beg you, read Tom Sowell's Discrimination Disparities. He outlines this better than I've seen anybody do it. There are so many other factors that are far more important to your own success than racism. But look what she's done. She's gone, okay, well, it took me 9 months. I couldn't get a job in my field. I watched my other white counterparts pursue the career that they went to school for, and they got it. So it must mean racism. When instead, you know, it's exactly like what our other friend just said. I forget what his name is by now, but the base one, Joshua. When he said, you know, you can't use it as a crutch, man. You can't use it as an excuse. And it's exactly what she's done. You know, there's this idea of taking extreme responsibility for everything that happens to you in life. No matter, I don't care if somebody comes up to you and says, this is racially motivated and I'm holding you down because I hate your race. Okay, deal with it. Take extreme responsibility for what just happened and move on with your life. I mean, F that person, but hey, it happened to you, it's done, it's over with, we move on. But instead, she's going, you know, I didn't get this job because of my race. My white counterparts didn't get it, when you did get it, when you could be taking inventory and taking stock on yourself and going, you know, and asking, hey, Jessica, what did you put on your resume that helped you get this job? Like, do you think we might have done anything differently? Is there a way that you approached the interview differently? Is there something else that you highlighted about yourself that I didn't highlight that maybe helped you get this job? Take that stock, take responsibility of your own failings or things that people just might not have recognized about you, and work on it from there. Don't go and talk about racism for the rest of your life because this one opportunity didn't work out for you, because there's going to be so many that do not work out. So many.
They're successful, I'm not.
This country was founded upon white people coming and then putting in act Jim Crow and other laws saying that if you are not white, you are genetically inferior. You are not even a person. And some of those laws are still, and those systems are still in place.
What law and what system is still in place? What law from Jim Crow, the Jim Crow era, is still in place today? I guarantee there's no answer to that question, because the Jim Crow laws do not exist anymore. Now, she can say the institutions that put forth those laws still exist, of course, and they will exist for as long as this country exists, I believe. But to say that there are still laws in place? Mm-mm.
Today, two things can be true. You can have had a very hard time. Privilege is not just limited to white people, but to say white privilege doesn't exist from a historical context, to me, is respectfully absurd.
Here's the problem, is that people use historical context to justify present discrimination and present beliefs that they have. Historical context is exactly that, historical context. Now, we can talk about how that affects people generationally, as they already admitted, that there are white people who have generationally been set at a place of advantage based on the transgressions of their ancestors. And guess what? That's just a fact. It's something that's happened. It's here. It exists. But does that mean that all white people benefit? No. So we just have to really be nuanced in the conversation, take a microscope to the issue itself, and be honest about the places where we're right and where we're wrong. And if we can't do that, then we're going to continue to have this race debate for decades to come.
Something that I learned about recently is the privilege that exists in the medical field, specifically relating to the birthing process in giving epidurals. There was a study that's recently, or was debunked, that said that Black people have a higher tolerance for pain, which then has been falsely used by people who help support births in being hesitant to provide the epidurals for Black women giving birth. A lot of women die in childbirth. I don't know the exact statistics. So
three times more likely Black women are to die.
Thank you. The fact that I will be taken seriously, more seriously than a Black woman in my place, if I should be giving birth at some point, I see that as just an absolute privilege.
Pause. I think we should do a whole episode on this at some point, because of all the examples of systemic racism, this seems to be a pretty withstanding one that people use, talking about the birth process and maternity. I haven't read up on it enough to give you a full episode on it, but I am dedicating myself now to reading into this. And again, as soon as somebody comes to me and says, you know, this is about racism and this is why people are being disparately impacted, the ears perk up, you know, I'm ready to listen and to hear about it. And I also have a list of other things that are going on in my brain that could be other explanations for why something like this is happening. So you have a death rate that's three times higher for Black women in the U.S. population than white women when it comes to giving birth. I'd love to see what it looks like for Hispanics, for Asians, for other racial demographics, because it seemed like we only look at Black and white these days. As far as the study that shows that Black people can tolerate pain more than white people can, she did mention that was debunked, as is so often the case with any scientific study that ever happens. These just happen to be ones that have race as the focus of them, which we can talk about, and I think is an important thing to do, because we do know that races medically present very differently. They have different medical conditions that can come along with them. As far as pain presentation and how much pain you can withstand, I don't know if that's something that deserves scientific merit, but as she stated, it's been debunked. Now, I'd love to see the evidence that proves that this one specific study that says that Black people can withstand more pain is truly influencing OBGYNs, midwives, and people who are in the position to assist in the birth of children. I would love to know how many of them have actually read that study and have allowed that to influence how they treat their patients. Here's a thing that I think we maybe could be looking at. How do these cultures, because we know black culture and white culture is very differently, how do they present? How do they communicate their pain to physicians and medical practitioners? Is there a difference in what each race is willing to admit when experiencing pain? Is there a difference in the response from medical practitioners when women tell them they are in pain? And we've seen this studied on a gender basis. We were having a major problem with the way that women were being treated by medical doctors and the way that men were. And people went and cried and said, this is patriarchy and this is oppression of women, and they are purposefully not listening to us. They're not taking into account what pains we're going through. They are missing our medical conditions purposefully. They're not giving them enough study time. But actually, when they looked at the different ways that men and women communicate, they found that there was a very big difference. Men would be outright, very direct and objective about the pain that they were feeling, could scale it back and say in very few words what they are experiencing, while women were more attached to narrative storytelling when it came to their pain and the medical conditions that they were experiencing. Now, when you present differently to a doctor, when you communicate differently to a doctor, guess what you're going to get? Different outcomes. Now, am I saying that is the complete and utter root of all of these maternity issues? No, by no means, because I have not read enough about it. But could that be an alternative to saying it's purely racism and doctors look at black people and think that they can experience more pain? Now, really think about that when you hear that and think about how ludicrous that sounds, that most OBGYNs and midwives just think that black women experience more pain and that's why they're having these problems with epidurals and birthing. So we have to, you know, give it a bird's eye view for a second and go, okay, well, what other things could be a problem here? Could it be that the age of black mothers who give birth and white mothers who give birth are different? Could it be that their communication skills are different? Could it be that they see different doctors? Could it be that they see doctors that are less certified in order to carry out these medical operations? So many things. I could go on and on and on about different reasons that this could be happening, but we'll do that in an episode.
My name is Bryn, and I just graduated, and I'm currently gaining hours to becoming a licensed therapist. As a therapist in school, we're taught to approach things with what's called cultural humility. Cultural humility is being curious, and instead of trying to have all the answers, working collaboratively with the client to kind of understand where they're coming from.
I have been fetishized for my race.
Taylor, you walking forward on that one?
Absolutely.
Well, according to your story, you have been fetishized for your race.
I guess so, yeah.
That is true.
I was being sarcastic, but yeah.
I 100% am walking forward on this one. I can't count on my hands and toes how many men have walked up to me and be like, where are you from? You look so exotic. I've never seen a skin tone like yours before. Happens all the time. Now, is that something that I go, oh my gosh, racism about? No, it's just a fact of life. People like things that are different that they haven't seen before, whatever. So you get the weird people who call you exotic and all these different things. So certainly walking forward.
You know, the standard one. Oh, you're pretty for a black girl. I'm like, that's not a compliment. That's so weird to say. And like one of the go-to pickup lines for men, they're like, oh my God, what are you? I'm like, this is not cute. I'm tired of having this conversation. This is lame. Yes, I know I have green eyes, hazel eyes. Like, let's move on.
I think black women in particular are just extremely sexualized and fetishized. Every day I go out, and making sure that my outfit is, you know, okay, because I don't want to draw certain attention. The way I wear my hair, if it's in an afro, if it's in puffs, if it's in braids, I'm going to get treated differently. Yeah, every single day, something happens.
So there's...
Every single day. Okay.
A form of positive anti-Semitism where Jews are perceived as, like, being put together, coming from money, being doctors, lawyers, and, you know, women are attracted to those sort of things. And then also, too, like, all Jewish men are circumcised. Some women have that preference. So I've definitely experienced it. But it's, I feel like it's a sort of subtle, trivial thing. Like, it never really bothered me. Mm-hmm. But it's occurred nonetheless.
Yeah, I've had experiences in high school, college. You know, people ask me to stop me, mainly women. Like, oh, are you Egyptian? Or are you black in this or black in that? There's always something, it's always black in something else. Yeah. And I'll, you know, let them know what I am, and they'd be like, oh, that's exotic, or something crazy. Yeah. You know, my name is Dino, and I am biracial. I don't want people to think that I'm, like, split between being black or white. I acknowledge that I'm mixed and I'm biracial, but for the most part, growing up, I was always considered black. I consider myself black. My family did as well. So I don't think we should live in a colorblind society, but I also don't think we should stay stuck and feel like we can't move forward and still thrive and accomplish things because of our skin color and where we live in America.
I mean, there's not much else. We're out of time here because it's 4 o'clock, so I'm going to pause there, and we could revisit this view. You guys would like to see the final prompt on this video. But all in all, I think a really great, respectful conversation about what are now pressing issues of the time for some reason. And I admire all these people for coming and being calm and having these discussions about these important subject matters. Hopefully some of them see this video and see some of the counterpoints that we've discussed today to the more progressive ideology when it comes to racism in America, and maybe are influenced a little bit. As far as what I've seen, yeah, I'm just impressed to see that we can come and coexist and have these discussions. Taylor, any final thoughts?
I think it's telling watching this. For one, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's really refreshing to hear a conversation about a difficult topic where people are actually using their brains. But even within that, to your point, over and over again, it seems like the people who are reading racism into everything are using their brains to justify that preconceived notion and mm-hmm. saying, oh, this snippet of history or this way I can frame it justifies that idea. And it robs them of that ability to think critically and be truth-seeking, yep. Which is kind of when you're saying, hey, let's look at this. There's a multivariate analysis we can do on this and cut it on a pie chart of blame of why this phenomenon is happening in society. You see this phenomenon and then you say 100% of the pie chart is systemic racism.
Yes.
Whereas a nuanced, critical thinking person who's truth-seeking will say, okay, well, maybe that's a slice, but what are the other possible slices? And then we can assign them or weight them based on how they're contributing to it. But each one should be rooted in facts and evidence and reason. And if you just sweep everything but the race stuff under the rug, you're not living in reality.
Yep.
And so it's like what you believe, what you are predisposed to believe about reality can be so powerful, and it robs you of living in the truth and knowing the truth. And I mean, someone once said the truth will set you free when you know it.
That's very true. And to your point, where that's going to hurt the most is lives are going to be lost because of it. You know, if we look at that maternity example specifically, and we look at that and we go, okay, well, black women are 3 times more likely to die during childbirth. That's racism. And that's all it is. And we need to fix it somehow, but I don't know how. And we need to start rooting out the racist obstetricians and OBGYNs and all these things. Well, guess what? You're going to do a whole lot of nothing when the problem doesn't change because you didn't look at any other route. Now, could some of that be due to racism? Absolutely. I'm not casting that aside and saying it is not an option. But let's say that one of the three in the 3 times more likely is due to racism. What about those other two? What about those other two? And because you've said all of this is due to racism and we need to root out the racist and the racist treatment in this medical profession, guess what? You still got 2 times those black women who are going to continue to die giving childbirth because you've refused to look at any other angle. So we need to open up the conversation, surely, more than it is open right now. And I can't wait till the day that happens. I will be fighting for the day that it happens. And I hope you guys will be fighting alongside me. If you are, please like, subscribe, click the notification bell to be notified every single day when we go live. Give this stream a like and comment down below. What were your answers to these questions? Have you experienced racism in your life? And what were those experiences like? I would love if you guys had a conversation down below. If you guys wish I had said something that I didn't or made an argument that I didn't, put that in the comments down below. If there's an argument of mine that you would like to refute, put that in the comments down below. And if you have any sort of differing opinion or something outside of the scope of what we talked about today, leave that in the comments down below. And hopefully you guys will all look through and have an encouraging conversation amongst each other, because that's what we're trying to do with this channel. If you'd like to listen to our podcast rather than watch, go to Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review there, because the left has come for us and given us 1-star reviews, and now we're all over the place with our numbers there. So we want to get this show out to more people, get more people watching, get more people discussing the issues that matter to us. Thank you so much for watching. See you tomorrow, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Bye, guys.